Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Thank you for joining us on this day after the first day of the year. January 2nd, I'm Joe Matthew in Washington. As the nation's capital steers its attention here to these two terror attacks we have just been hearing about, and we just did get an update from the FBI's Deputy Assistant Director of its Counterterrorism Division, that's Christopher Rea, you were just hearing from, who says this was an act of terrorism, point blank. And an individual here, Shamsuddin Jabbar, who was, quote, 100% inspired by ISIS, unquote. The most surprising element to come from this news conference, which really answered one of the biggest questions that we had going into it, is they now believe Jabbar acted alone. Rea says, quote, we do not assess at this point anyone else is involved in this attack except for Shamsuddin Jabbar. Now, of course, we also had the investigation in Las Vegas. They did take some questions on that, answering another one of the major questions we've been asking over the past 24 hours. Knowing, of course, there's an FBI investigation in Las Vegas where the Cybertruck exploded in front of the Trump International Hotel. Quote, we are following up on all potential leads and ruling nothing out. However, at this point, there is no definitive link between the attack in New Orleans and the one in Las Vegas. Another quote from the FBI today in what was a very newsy briefing here. Knowing that the IEDs, we've learned now, that were planted in the French Quarter, in fact, were done so after midnight and a couple of hours before that attack that took place just after 3 a.m. on New Year's morning. We heard from the mayor of New Orleans as well, LaToya Cantrell, who made clear that they have cleared Bourbon Street. The city is back in possession of Bourbon Street with a plea for additional resources. They did clean Bourbon Street starting at 2 a.m., and they are now getting back to what is going to be an important day in New Orleans, of course, with the Sugar Bowl set for 4 p.m. Eastern time. The mayor of New Orleans saying, quote, not only are we ready for game day, but we're ready to host large-scale events in our city. We heard from Louisiana Governor Jeff Landry as well as they try to put a real show of force here in front of this story and transparency to their credit with what we know and what we don't know. And I want to remind everybody that some of these details can change. We've already seen that, remembering that frequently the first round of reporting is not always true. We had a lot of different things that we heard about now, beginning to clarify some of them here on Balance of Power. Welcome to the Thursday edition. I know it feels like a Monday for many of you, but it is Thursday here, and we've got a lot to talk about this day before the new Congress begins and some major national security events that are about to take hold here in Washington, D.C. That's why connecting the dots on these two stories would have been very important if authorities had the ability to do that. And we want to start our conversation today with Michael Shepard. Of course, joining us here in Washington as Bloomberg Senior Editor for Technology and Strategic Studies. We wanted to talk with Michael, though, because he's been covering politics and national security in Washington here for many years. And there are a lot of stories that cross over. Michael, it's great to see you, and I appreciate your coming. And Happy New Year, for starters. This was a terrible way for the year to begin for a lot of Americans looking at scenes of terror from New Orleans, from Las Vegas. But to hear from the authorities today, somewhat reassuring to believe, at least so far, that they are not connected.
Well, terrible, Joe, as you put it, but also unsettling, especially as Americans look to, you know, since the pandemic, really be able to revel once again in these large-scale events.
That's right.
Going to a ball game, celebrating New Year's Eve with friends in New Orleans, and attending major political events like we're about to host here in Washington, including the pre-inaugural event that Donald Trump intends to host at Capital One Arena just around the corner from our offices here, and of course, the inauguration on January 20th. But even before that, tomorrow, we have a new Congress being seated and a speaker election. Mm-hmm. And then on January 6th, remember that date, they will be certifying the 2024 election results.
Yeah.
So people have in their memory and their sense of things that can go wrong, and it is something that they are concerned about. And this is what law enforcement and public safety authorities and political authorities, including the governor of Louisiana and the mayor of New Orleans, are trying to express this confidence and also this sense that they want to get back on their feet quickly.
There were a lot of concerns, not only seeing a cyber truck, but also the location of Trump International, that there might have been some timing here to coincide with the incoming president here or reaction to the election of some sort. But we have to remind ourselves that these just could be two deranged people.
That's
and
right.
According to the FBI, had nothing to do with one another.
And yeah, the FBI was quick to say that they see no immediate connection between these two events, as terrible as they were. Mm-hmm. We know quite a bit less about what took place in Las Vegas based on what we've heard from authorities so far. So we will have to see what more they can tell us about the nature of the explosion of this Cybertruck, the fact that it was a vehicle produced by one of Elon Musk's companies at a hotel owned by Donald Trump, in essence. It really does raise a lot of questions. And Musk himself furthered those questions by suggesting yesterday on X that there could be a link between these two events, and also suggesting that it was a bomb and not the vehicle itself that may have caused the explosion. So we don't really know. We don't have a definitive assessment from authorities about what took place.
What do you make of the reaction we're hearing by this? You know, an interesting scenario when we've got an outgoing president and a president-elect both almost carrying equal weight when it comes to commenting on a story like this. We should let our audience know, by the way, about 10 minutes from now, Joe Biden is expected with his national security team to sit down in the Situation Room for a briefing on this. But a lot of people are looking at the reaction from Donald Trump. And while we heard from Joe Biden yesterday, he actually went on national television, Trump took to Truth Social and started to blame the border to sort of prove some of his suggestions
and
as
a number of his
being
supporters.
Correct.
They
did. Let's talk about what he said. When I said the criminals coming in are far worse than the criminals we have in our country, that statement was constantly refuted by Democrats and the fake news media, but it turned out to be true. Of course, it's false, Michael. This is an American who served in the military.
An American who served in the military and served in the military for a number of years. He was somebody who apparently held a good paying job, lived in Houston, and is somebody you wouldn't necessarily connect to an event like this in the way that Donald Trump was trying to do. The Republican Party has tried to make the border security question, one, wrapped around national security, two, in terms of terrorism, by suggesting that the people who perpetrate these kinds of attacks with fealty or association with foreign extremist movements, that they have somehow crept over the border into the U.S. through some surreptitious means, when in this case, we saw that not to be the case. And the president-elect was commenting well before anybody in the investigation had been able to comment or offer any kind of clarification.
Yeah, went on to say the crime rate in our country is at a level that no one has ever seen before, which is also not factual. It brings us back a little bit to the tweet storms that we used to see in the first administration. What does it make you think? Because you covered that White House, Michael. You helped our bureau edit coverage from that White House, and we're about to do it again.
Well, we remember it all well. And there was a question about Trump as he was being elected. We all talked about it that night, and I think we were discussing it, you and me, election night, and in the days after. Will we see a different Donald Trump? Will we see a Trump 2.0 that will be a little bit more restrained, a little bit more serene, or above doing that kind of, incendiary or provocative kind of challenge and communication to the world? But we're seeing already via Truth Social, via his posts, that he is not holding back anything.
Raring to go here on a day like this with a lot of misinformation.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, "Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130."
you're just joining us here on Bloomberg, we welcome you with some updates on the situation in New Orleans from the FBI and from officials in the city. We just heard from and brought you a briefing live here. The FBI is calling this an act of terrorism, but also making clear that Shamsuddin Jabbar, as far as they know now, was not linked to the attack in New Orleans and, in fact, acted alone. We are going to get further updates here, knowing that some of these details can evolve. We heard a little bit earlier as well. Who do we have here, guys, from that briefing? This is Christopher Rea, again, speaking for the FBI, who is Deputy Assistant Director for the FBI's Counterterrorism Division a short time ago in New Orleans. Let's listen.
There's also an FBI investigation in Las Vegas. We are following up on all potential leads and not ruling everything out. However, at this point, there is no definitive link between the attack here in New Orleans and the one in Las Vegas.
Michael, I want to talk to you about journalism for a moment. Mm-hmm. This is your profession. While you talk with authority about a lot of different things, I want to go back to something that I mentioned earlier, because you remember how frequently the first draft of history is wrong. Speak to us about the process of going through how little we still know at this point when you're crafting a story and the governor that you have to put on your own inclinations to cover what you're hearing.
We all remember the name Richard Jewell.
Oh, man.
And we remember the story about 1996.
That's right.
And the bombing at Centennial Park during the Atlanta Olympics, and how very quickly law enforcement authorities were putting blame on this man who actually was, it turned out, a hero in trying to save lives and get people away from the scene, and how it upended his life and it ended up being completely wrong. And there was somebody else, a domestic terrorist, we should note, Eric Rudolph, who was later blamed for it. And so we can see that the first draft of history is quite rough. And that is one of the risks that we run in reporting on this. We have to make sure that we're attributing it, that we're gut-checking it, and we're not just going through the motions of putting out there anything that we are hearing from authorities. It's important for us to say with authority and clarity ourselves that it's early, there's still a lot of things we don't know, and also emphasize what it is that we don't know as well.
So we're bringing you into the newsroom now. These are literally the conversations that we have, and this is why you can trust Bloomberg. Knowing that this is our approach here, we just knocked down another bit of misinformation. And that was the idea that this this man in New Orleans, Jabbar, was wearing a suicide vest. The FBI wanted to be very deliberate, was very deliberate in knocking that down.
Yes, they were deliberate in knocking that down, and also debunking the number of improvised explosive devices that had been found. Mm-hmm. There were reports circulating in the hours after the 3:15 a.m. New Year's Day attack that there may have been several devices, but the FBI was quick to say that there were only two found in the vicinity of the scene. They are still scouring the area and the larger city of New Orleans, of course, ahead of the Sugar Bowl this afternoon. But they wanted to make clear that this was not as wide-scale or coordinated as they had initially feared yesterday.
I mentioned earlier, Michael, that we heard from Joe Biden. He spoke in the second half of the day yesterday. Let's listen to the president.
We're tracking the explosion of a Cybertruck outside the Trump Hotel in Las Vegas. Law enforcement and the intelligence community are investigating this as well, including whether there's any possible connection to the attack in New Orleans. Thus far, there's nothing to report on that score at this time. While this person committed a terrible assault on the city, the spirit of our New Orleans will never, never, never be defeated.
I'm sure Joe Biden didn't think he'd be spending his New Year's Day talking about this as they wind things down at the White House. Where's the line when this becomes an event that draws the president to that level where he needs to go before the cameras to try to get the confidence and trust of the American people in a time of uncertainty like this?
Well, this is one of those moments where being presidential and acting presidential is so key, because the public is looking for that reassurance. Now, what rises to that level? There are certain moments that are unforgettable. We remember Sandy Hook and how that shook the nation to its very core, and how then President Barack Obama reacted, and his public display of emotion, sharing what the nation felt in the moment. And there are other episodes when it's critical for the president to really try to bring the nation together and offer that sense of security. And it's not just the president, of course, as we saw the governor of Louisiana, Jeff Landry, the mayor of New Orleans,
of course,
doing
right.
the same thing. But for the president, it is an essential function where the president really provides that mm-hmm. sense of reassurance, that sense of confidence, that sense we have things under control.
Yeah, it's something that only a president is capable of doing, and it reminds
right.
us of how impossible it is to prepare for moments like these. You simply have to be in the job.
Right.
Michael, we're talking about not only the Sugar Bowl later today, but a Super Bowl.
Oh.
In the Superdome. We're
yeah.
talking about a presidential inauguration here. We're talking about January 6th. You already put your fingers on some of these massive national security events. How does all of this change them?
Well, it will further heighten the awareness and the alert level. Mm-hmm. But you and I both know that the alert level here in D.C., even during normal times, it really couldn't be higher. And yet they do have to be on their toes in a way that, you know, they think, hey, we have to take it up even
sure.
further. We remember going all the way back to 1995. That was a time when you could drive on Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the White House.
Yeah.
That area has steadily been cordoned off and blocked off, and now you really can't even cross it. And the amount of security around the U.S. Capitol, mm-hmm. too, has been heightened to a great degree, not only because of 9/11, not only because of January 6th, but if you go all the way back to the time when a deranged gunman
right.
burst into the Capitol and shot several people, including a Capitol police officer. This is, you know, these are the kinds of events that authorities are having to brace for in a way that, you know, it makes Americans uncomfortable. Mm. We like to think we would have access to these places, but, you know, we live in a free and open society. But the security needs are really overwhelming us, the people, and the officials who have
sure.
to maintain those barriers.
Michael Shepherd's helping us bring back a lot of memories, a lot of tough ones in this case. I was in Washington on the day of the Oklahoma City bombing when they shut down Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yeah.
It never reopened. That wasn't the plan that day.
You're right, John.
But it never reopened. And
yeah.
I wonder if that's going to be the story for Bourbon Street. I know that it's back in the possession of the city.
Yeah.
They cleaned things up this morning. But why shouldn't that be a pedestrian-only way?
Well, and this would really further calls for that. They had
yeah.
planned to put in some heightened security, mm-hmm. some additional bollards to
yep,
block
yep.
vehicular traffic. That hasn't been carried out yet. We'll probably see that accelerated at some point in the mm-hmm. wake of all this. And other cities will have to investigate whether to do this in other heavily trafficked pedestrian byways, too. Do they need to close some of those off as well to vehicular traffic mm-hmm. for these same reasons? And, you know, there are other aesthetic and urban planning reasons as well where
right.
maybe you don't want cars on that street so people can enjoy it,
How
too.
True. Yeah, the
yeah.
bollards are coming. And,
yeah.
boy, you wonder if that has an echo effect in other cities with congested pedestrian-heavy areas like this. They were closing down Newbury Street in Boston mm-hmm. just for shopping days because
well,
it's so difficult to get around. New York
mm-hmm.
has its version of
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and Broadway and Times
Absolutely.
Square have long since been closed to mm-hmm. to vehicular traffic,
mm-hmm.
giving pedestrians much greater leeway to move around and enjoy the area, but it also does provide a measure of security for
right.
them, too.
We have 14 souls who were lost in New Orleans. That number 15 you may have just heard, by the way, from authorities does include the driver, does include Jabbar. There are going to be funerals, tributes, remembrances.
Yes.
Will the president be part of them?
That's a good question, and it's unclear what those plans are. We are, as authorities were quick to remind us during that news conference today, only 24 hours removed from the event itself. So the plans are still taking place, and the president will have a busy schedule, too, because
mm-hmm.
speaking of funerals, we also have the state
That's
funeral
right.
scheduled for Jimmy Carter
yeah.
on January 9th. And he is expected to give a eulogy there.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, you know, a real moment for the nation in terms of reflection and mourning and an appreciation, of course, for Jimmy Carter as
yes,
well.
Yes, of course. It's a sobering moment and one that we like to think Washington is ready for. But if there's anyone we could have spent time with today to help us make sense of this, it was Michael Shepard. And Michael, I thank you so much for the time here, reporting for Bloomberg in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
The confirmation hearings, and there's a lot of crossover here with what we're talking about, the events in New Orleans and Las Vegas, has prompted John Thune himself, the incoming majority leader, to call for a hastening or an advance in the schedule for these confirmation hearings so the national security team specifically can be put together in time for the inauguration. It's unclear if that's possible. And that's where we start our conversation with Laura Davison, who directs our political coverage here in Washington, D.C. at Bloomberg. Happy New Year, Laura. It's great to see you. Is that something that will come from the events of the last 24 hours, an accelerated confirmation schedule for Donald Trump's team?
You'll certainly see pushing for that. You know, we saw Stephen Miller sort of in the aftermath of all of this saying, look, this really just makes the case that we need to get all of these national security folks confirmed as soon as possible. You know, there's already some of these top administration officials. Pete Hegseth, he already has his confirmation hearing in the Senate for January 13th. So you're starting to see those get scheduled. However, there's already sort of a pushback from Democrats saying, look, we're going to move methodically. We're not going to hasten things just because of the events of recent days.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's also a question as to whether some of the pushback against these nominees, like Tulsi Gabbard, for example, who's faced a lot of scrutiny over her relationship with the now ousted dictator in Syria, Bashar al-Assad, if the scrutiny actually gets more intense, if there is concern about a resurgence of some of these terrorist groups or those affiliated them or pledging allegiance to them, as the FBI said, the New Orleans attacker specifically was inspired by ISIS.
This is going to be really interesting. Lawmakers are going to come back into town, today, later tomorrow, and they've had, basically 2 weeks when they've been away from each other. They haven't been talking, and sort of some of the concerns of, 2024 are now old news, and these new things come to light, particularly, with the events in Syria in December as well. That Tulsi Gabbard is one of those names that has come up as someone, who if Republicans are going to say, okay, there's one that we're not going to confirm. She's sort of at the top of that list. Mm-hmm. We'll see kind of how these things shape up going forward. There were at least signs that potentially the New Orleans attacker, the suspect there, was inspired by ISIS. We'll see how that moves forward as investigators continue.
Just constantly blown away by how quickly the news cycle and the conversation can change. But I suspect these hearings are going to be difficult one way or the other. Does it make the others more likely? For instance, Pete Hegseth more likely to be confirmed? Will it maybe move up the date for Kash Patel's not supposed to have a hearing till the middle of February at this point?
It's certainly possible. On the Hegseth front, a lot of Trump's closest allies, they said, look, if he can kind of survive those really raucous 2 or 3 weeks he had, he's probably good to go. That if you didn't have more people coming out saying, look, I can't support him, that ultimately people would fall in line. We saw that with Joni Ernst. She didn't say outright she would support him, but she said she would support him through the process, whatever that means specifically. On Kash Patel, he's another one who, people have raised some concerns about. But the calendar is just going to get really tricky, because the Senate has all these rules and procedures, and there's a lot of stuff they want to do. They want to do an immigration bill, in the Senate as one of the first things. The House doesn't necessarily agree on doing that yet. We'll see what whoever the next speaker is, where they go. But there's just a lot of things that Republicans have said they want to do on day one. And day one, like every other day, is only 24 hours and only so much you can fit in.
Well, let's talk about who that next speaker is, because obviously Mike Johnson would like to stay in the job. Donald Trump has suggested he wants Mike Johnson to stay in the job, as does Elon Musk. But we have very serious questions as to whether tomorrow, when the new Congress convenes, Mike Johnson is going to be able to get the votes. How steep is this climb, the hill he has to climb? And is there anyone else who could climb it if not him?
So he could only lose, we'll see who actually shows up in the room that tomorrow to vote, but he could only lose a handful of votes. You have Tom Massey saying no, he won't vote. There's not a clear person if it's not Mike Johnson, then who? You floated Chip Roy earlier. He is someone who has sort of built a following in the House, except he also has bad beef with Donald Trump. They go back, he supported DeSantis in the primary, and Trump is unlikely to come out and support him. Jim Jordan's name has always come up during these discussions. But it's not clear. Steve Scalise, also he ran last time. He has had some of his own health issues, though he does have broad support within the conference. Mm-hmm. It's possible that we go through several rounds of voting, 2 or 3 or 4 rounds of voting for some protest votes that have the Republicans get out of their system. And then ultimately,
that's
Mike
Johnson.
That's
a win after Kevin McCarthy, right? Anything below 15,
less than 15,
you're good.
Exactly.
So this is going to be a real tense moment. It's possible he sails through and then that particular drama is behind us. But his job is still on the line no matter what happens. You know, you all you have to do is make a couple Republicans mad, and he could be out of a job.
Yeah. Narrowest majority we've seen in, what, almost a century?
Majority of one is what we're on track for.
It's not going to be easy for him. Bloomberg's Laura Davison, our politics editor here in Washington. Thank you so much. Now, we are just learning from authorities in Las Vegas related to, of course, the Cybertruck explosion that happened there, that the Las Vegas Police Department will be holding a briefing less than an hour from now at 2 p.m. Eastern time pertaining, of course, to that incident, which authorities did tell us earlier today they do not believe is necessarily directly related, at least they can't say so definitively, to the attack that happened in New Orleans in the early hours of New Year's Day.
Yeah, that's for sure. This also was a deadly event. As we learn more about the driver and the source, both of these vehicles came from that same Turo service that had a lot of folks attempting to connect the dots. But as of now, we don't have the ability to do that. No definitive link, according to the FBI.
No definitive link. But what the FBI did say definitively was that the events that took place in New Orleans, an attack that killed 14 people plus the suspected perpetrator, was terrorism.
Let me be very clear about this point. This was an act of terrorism. It was premeditated and an evil act. This was obviously a critical incident, and with that, lots of information and tips come pouring in from law enforcement, first responders, and the public.
We want to get more reaction now to these events and what they mean and turn to Jane Harman, who is chair of the Commission on the National Defense Strategy, also former congresswoman from California, and author of Insanity Defense, Why Our Failure to Confront Hard National Security Problems Makes Us Less Safe. Jane, thank you so much for being with us here on Bloomberg TV and radio. As we consider the FBI's characterization of this individual, Jabbar specifically, as someone who at this time they believe was a lone wolf inspired by ISIS, it raises the question of how the U.S. can better combat radicalized lone wolf terrorists like this?
Well, this continues to be a very hard challenge. Soft targets like 3 a.m. in Las Vegas when the bollards are down, in New Orleans when the bollards are down, or Las Vegas are hard to protect totally. I mean, New Orleans has to do a better job yesterday. But it is interesting that both attacks occurred right around the new year. And the local authorities have said there's no connection, but I would just offer the fact that there are copycats and there could be more, and I hope we don't have a failure of imagination here. It seems to me there would be motivation by ISIS because of how Syria has gone, and we have attacked them in Syria, we the U.S., to hit more soft targets in the U.S. And let me just point out that they're not targeting Democrats or Republicans, they're targeting America. So we better pull together a little here, as we did after 9/11, and understand that our country, not just one party, is under attack. And that motivates me to say one more thing. These people were not illegals coming across the southern border. Let's get over this. I'm not saying there isn't a border issue, and a bill could have passed months ago if Trump hadn't blocked it. But I'm saying that there are other threats to America and to our infrastructure from many countries and many terror groups. And having a responsible group of people in chairs in the, at the Pentagon and the DNI and all the other senior law and the FBI law enforcement positions matters.
Well, indeed, the point's taken, Jane, and we haven't seen a correction on that Truth Social post. But I wonder your thoughts on what we heard from the outgoing director of the FBI, who has been framed as a sort of bad guy by the incoming administration. He's basically been fired or forced to resign. But it was Christopher Wray who repeatedly said in congressional testimony last year that the United States faced a significant threat from lone wolf terrorists inspired by the events in the Middle East specifically. And now we have this truck with the ISIS flag and basically what the FBI director was warning us was going to happen. Does he need to be acknowledged for being right?
He was right. And he's not the first person to say this. We've been talking about this since 9/11. Right after 9/11, I became ranking member on the House Intelligence Committee. And we talked, again, not on a partisan basis, about threats to America. He is right. I'm kind of sorry he's resigning. He has a 10-year position. And he's now creating a circumstance where possibly the Trump appointee or whoever is confirmed for the position may be forced out in less than 10 years. The whole point of a 10-year tenure was to put him beyond political whims, mm-hmm. sort of like the Supreme Court, but they have life tenure. But the point is to make the FBI an independent agency, and I worry a lot that that could change very quickly.
Well, you're alluding to, Jane, of course, Kash Patel, who has been nominated to lead the FBI next, needs to be confirmed, as does Tulsi Gabbard, who has been tapped to lead or be the director of national intelligence. There's Pete Hegseth, who's been tapped for defense secretary as well. Do these events make all of those confirmations easier to achieve in the U.S. Senate?
Unclear. I know that that's what the Trump administration is pushing. But if I were senator, which I'm not, and I wanted to exercise my responsibility to approve these nominees, I would want this to go at a reasonable pace, not too slow, but not too fast. Putting the wrong people in these positions, and the Senate has to determine if they're wrong, really violates the Senate responsibility to advise and consent. And I would point out that the Senate hasn't passed budgets on time since 2011, the year I left, kind of interesting. And they haven't done this function, or they may not do this function well. And they have passed on all opportunities to authorize wars. And we've been in a few of them. And, you know, at some point, some voter's going to say, hey, buddy, what are you doing in your job? And I really think this is crunch time for the United States Senate. And there's some excellent senators in both parties who I hope will step up and do whatever they think is the right thing here.
How's Joe Biden doing, Jane, in these final weeks of his administration? He was before the American people yesterday. I suspect he might speak again today or tomorrow after being briefed in the Situation Room on what happened in New Orleans and Las Vegas. Should he try to correct some of the information that Donald Trump is putting out here? What is the role as these two essentially compete for attention in the next 3 weeks?
Well, Joe Biden has a diminished audience. I think he has been pitch perfect on the Jimmy Carter death and planning the funeral. I look forward to attending it myself, since I was deputy cabinet secretary in the Carter White House and have some very fond memories of Carter. And one of the things that's heartening is that his 4 years in the White House has been reviewed and reconsidered. He didn't do everything right, but he was a moral conscience, and we surely need one now. And Biden gets that. Biden endorsed Carter, was the first senator to endorse Carter back in the day, and they were good friends. And he stepped up to that, and he does need to speak out here if he has an opinion. Certainly, he should. I think this claim that these people crossed the border to carry out these attacks, which is totally bogus, has to be corrected.
It's great to have you back, Jane, especially on this day. Happy New Year to you, despite the news that we've been discussing. And we look forward to another year of conversation with Jane Harman, chair of the Commission on the National Defense Strategy, former congresswoman, of course, with a lot of questions still to be answered, Kaylee, though the FBI has been doing a pretty good job knocking down misinformation, ideas of connections that may not exist. And the fact that he apparently the attacker in New Orleans was not wearing a suicide vest, as had been reported early on, the FBI saying that's not true as well.
Yeah, and again, the FBI saying that they do believe that it was just a single suspect that was involved in that attack in Louisiana, a lone wolf at this time, and they do not believe the public is in danger. We'll have much more still ahead here on Bloomberg TV and radio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Tomorrow's going to be a big kickoff as well in Washington as the 119th Congress takes its seats. And of course, a pretty big order of business has to happen first in the House of Representatives, and that is an election of a speaker. It's required for the chamber to get on with the course of the rest of its business, including the swearing in of members. Mike Johnson, of course, is the current speaker of the House. Donald Trump has said he would like Johnson to remain so, as has Elon Musk. But already, at least one Republican member of Congress, Congressman Tom Massey, has said Johnson will not get his vote, and he can only afford to lose one more with a very tight margin in the House at this time. Mike Johnson pled his case on Fox News this morning.
We're going to get this done. Look, I'm humbled and honored to have President Trump's endorsement for the role again, as well as the endorsement of leaders across the conservative spectrum and the Republican Party, all of my colleagues that are standing with us, and we will get this done. Look, the things that we're talking about this morning are an illustration that we live in very serious times. We cannot afford any palace drama here. We have got to get the Congress started, which begins tomorrow, and we have to get immediately to work.
Did he say palace drama in this House of Representatives? Let's assemble our panel. They're with us on this first program of the new year. Jeannie Shanzano, Senior Democracy Fellow with the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress Democratic Analyst, and Republican Strategist Rick Davis, partner at Stone Court Capital. They are both Bloomberg Politics contributors. And great to have you both with us here. I don't know if the math is working for you here, Jeannie, but I believe Hakeem Jeffries said not a single Democratic vote. So that means that Mike Johnson can basically only lose one. His name is Tom Massey. Are we going to have a speaker tomorrow?
I thought the same thing, by the way, about the palace drama. I guess he's fancying himself the king or the prince or something. You know, can I just throw a monkey wrench in this whole thing and say, if I was Donald Trump, I would be on the phone with Matt Gaetz saying, get yourself to Washington, D.C., you go in, and you make this a 220, because as you and Kaylee keep talking about, it's 219, he can only afford the one. Gaetz gets in there, he can afford a little bit more. It wouldn't, you know, be a home run, but that's what I'd be doing if I was Donald Trump today, and give Mike Johnson a little bit more breathing room.
I'm sure there are plenty of people on Capitol Hill right now praying, Jeannie, that exact scenario does not happen. Former Congressman Matt Gaetz has said he doesn't intend to take his seat that he was elected to for the 119th, though I guess we can't rule anything out. Barring that scenario, Rick, we obviously know about Tom Massey. There have been other Republicans who have cast a lot of doubt on whether or not they would support Mike Johnson, thinking here specifically of Congressman Chip Roy of Texas. How hard is this going to be tomorrow?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think Jeannie kind of alludes to what the really magic could be here, and that is changing the denominator. It's 51% of people, you know, members voting on the floor at the time. So anytime you take someone on or off the board, it changes the overall configuration. So you're right, he can't afford to lose two, but if there are fewer members voting, and that includes both Democrats and Republicans, then it could actually enhance his chances of winning. And I think, you know, the big question is Victoria Sparks. Is she going to show up? She said she's not going to caucus. She's not interested in playing party politics. So she could actually enhance Johnson's opportunity to be speaker on the first ballot if she doesn't show up. And also there are others who have problems with Johnson. You know, some of the Freedom Caucus members, Andy Biggs from Arizona, good example. He's not real keen on Johnson. He hasn't said whether he'll support him or not. Just don't show up. He'll make his case that he never voted for him, and at the same time, he actually helps him get elected. So that is a pretty typical Washington parlor game. I wouldn't be surprised to see it play out here. My guess is that Democrats all show up in force. So the more Republicans that don't show up, the easier it is for them to actually get Speaker Johnson elected.
Rick just said something important, Jeannie, that he passes on the first round. Is that the job tomorrow? Or after what we saw with Kevin McCarthy, is it anything under 15 is a win?
I think anything under 15. Listen, at this point, if they can get a speaker tomorrow, even if it takes a few rounds, that would be a good thing. And of course, the person everybody is watching, because we know, as Kaylee mentioned, that Massey is a sperm no, is what happens with Chip Roy. And what we understand is he has said, maybe Mike Johnson names him chair of the Rules Committee. That may help him get to a yes, because he's not a firm no yet. So in addition to the denominator issue that Rick was talking about, a lot of this is going to be, what can you do for me, Mike Johnson? What kind of carrots can you give to get me to yes, or at least to stay out of the chamber, and so you can get to yes? And that's what we'll be watching as well. You know, if they were to name Chip Roy chair of the committee, he's already on it. That would be problematic for a lot of other Republicans. And, you know, Democrats are going to be there in full force. Even Nancy Pelosi, who broke her hip recently, is going to be there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we heard that from the Speaker Emerita herself today from the airplane. As we consider this notion that this obviously has to happen at some point to certify the results of the presidential election, which is scheduled to take place on Monday, January 6th. Rick, it speaks to the very serious nature of the business the House does have to deal with in pretty short order. Not just, of course, that, but then there's other things happening in January, including a state funeral for former President Jimmy Carter on the 9th, and there's the inauguration on January 20th. Just given this very stacked calendar of events, how much pressure does that put on this situation and Mike Johnson specifically to try to find a resolution here by potentially, say, negotiating the rules package that was put out in the last few days?
That's right. This is no typical year in transition. Republicans now have each of the chambers of power, the Senate, the White House, and the House. There's an expectation that because of that, they'll step out lively and get a lot done in the first 100 days. Forget, you know, even how much they can get done in the first year. And so I think there's enormous pressure there. And then, of course, you point out the constitutional requirements. This is a presidential election year. So you have to actually certify the election on the 6th of January. And you have to actually have an inaugural on the 20th. And so these are deadlines that are gonna really press hard on the willingness to have a lot of mischief in this first day. I think that it's actually going to make it easier for Johnson. Nobody's that enthusiastic about him. Nobody thinks that his first year in office was particularly smooth or successful. And so there's not like a desperate want to have him in his leadership. But the reality is he's short a couple votes maybe today. Everybody else on the list of likely successors would be short 30 or 40 votes on the first ballot. Yeah. And so the Republicans know that the minute they reject Johnson, they open themselves up to a lot of potential political harm and delays that could actually put pressure on these important constitutional dates. So, yeah, it's not so much everyone's excited about Johnson getting another term as speaker, but they fear the outcome if he's not. And that is enough probably to get him over.
Well, for the benefit of our radio listeners, we had a graphic up showing the busy month of January. Starting tomorrow with the new Congress, as Kaylee mentioned, we go through the 6th, the election certification, Jimmy Carter's state funeral on January 9th. We have the inaugural, of course, on the 20th. I'll add Donald Trump's rally here downtown at the Cap Center. That'll be the night before the inauguration. Jeannie, there are a lot of questions about securing these events after what took place yesterday in Las Vegas and New Orleans. Realizing now, according to the FBI, these events, however, were not connected. Does that make us feel better about managing these massive security events in the nation's capital?
You know, I don't know if it makes us feel any better. Even if we go before what happened in New Orleans and Las Vegas, we see the president-elect, he was victimized by two attempted assassinations, just really unprecedented amount of violence in this last presidential election. Now, these two incidents, which, as you mentioned, they're saying are not connected, but it is still an environment so scary in terms of the amount of violence. I'm even just thinking about the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court just issued his annual State of the Court report, and the number one issue he highlighted was the challenge that justices are facing as it pertains to threats to their life, violence. We even have a justice of the Supreme Court wearing a bulletproof vest. So I think all of these, what's going to happen in DC over the next month, security is going to be very tight. They're already starting to plan boarding up the place. And I think it really is going to be a big challenge. Are we up to the challenge? Absolutely. And we have enough notice of these events for sure. Yeah. But as we've seen in the last few days, just one lone wolf can do enormous amount of damage.
Well, and we can add a few items to the calendar in January, Rick. For example, January 14th is when the confirmation hearings for the nominee for Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth will begin. As we consider these national security-oriented cabinet officials who want to join the second Trump administration, how much do the events of the last 36 hours influence their confirmation prospects?
Well, it puts a lot more heat on them, right? So nobody's going to want to see delays in this process. So they've laid out a schedule for many of these national security appointees. to have committee hearings, which would then trigger, obviously, votes on the floor of the Senate. And so, yes, nobody wants to see that delayed. And of course, on top of that, it'll put more pressure on things like background checks to be done on time, so there are no delays to that process. So it creates tension inside the system. And as Jeannie was talking about the Supreme Court, I was reminded, in addition to all these things happening in January, don't forget that the Supreme Court will be hearing the TikTok case in just a couple of weeks. And so we'll have lots to talk about on balance of power throughout the month of January.
Oh, you best believe it. And you best believe we'll be talking to our signature political panel about all of these things. Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano here with us on our first show of the new year 2025. Thank you so much to you both. Joe, I'm tired already. And it's literally just begun.
Yeah, don't worry. You'll have this weekend to eat your Wheaties. We'll come back full strength. We are full strength today. They're all with us in the Bureau. Stay here on Bloomberg TV and radio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
As we try to get our arms around the start of this new Congress, it will be right at this time tomorrow. We'll be talking with you on Bloomberg TV and radio about what may be happening with a speaker's vote. Of course, to bring in the new Congress, to swear in the new Congress, you need to have a Speaker of the House. And somebody who knows a little bit about that is Brittany Martinez, who worked in Kevin McCarthy's Speaker's office, Republican strategist and founder of Espina & Company. It's great to have you back, Brittany. Happy New Year. What's your expectation for tomorrow when the 119th Congress attempts to begin?
Well, thank you for having me back and a happy new year to you as well. You know what? I think that Johnson's going to get the vote. I don't know if it's going to happen on a first round. I do think that a little bit of chaos is going to ensue, but he did get the Donald Trump endorsement. So I think his speakership is safe for the most part.
Well, so let's talk about that Trump endorsement, because many people have suggested to us that that is what would make or break anyone's speaker's bid. But it doesn't seem that Trump is necessarily swaying the minds of those lawmakers that we have greatest question about. Tom Massey, as we've repeatedly said, is a firm no, but we're unclear on people like Chip Roy or Andy Biggs. Keeping in mind, Chip Roy endorsed Ron DeSantis in the Republican presidential primary initially. So does Chip Roy really care what Trump says?
I think that the folks that are the most concerned are probably the ones that you mentioned and may not care that much what the former president has to say. But there were some folks during the CR who were very tough on Johnson beyond those people. So I think in that sense, it'll help those people, the freshmen coming in, I think that it'll sway their vote. But yes, you're right. There are the couple of outstanding ones from the Freedom Caucus, especially, who probably won't vote for Johnson, at least not on the first or second vote. I would expect it to maybe go to three votes. If it went longer than that, I would be a little bit surprised. But it's a 119th Congress. Hopefully things will be more normal than they have been. But it's been a weird few years. So I think that he doesn't have it on the first time.
All right. This is good, though. Brittany Martinez tells us three rounds. I'm going to remember this tomorrow. Brittany will play the tape back. We're hearing anything less than 15 is a good look for Mike Johnson. There's a question, though, about whether the gentleman from Florida shows up. Is Matt Gaetz going to show up tomorrow to be sworn in and help Mike Johnson and Donald Trump with the math?
I wouldn't be surprised if Gaetz shows up, but I think he just likes to be a little bit of a chaos agent. I don't know if he would go through the whole motions of being sworn in and doing a vote for Johnson, maybe. Again, I know we talk about this every time. It's been a few weird years in politics, but I don't know if I see him going through all those steps, if he's going to just step back again. But maybe he shows up just like George Santos keeps showing up, just to sort of be involved. And he starts, I think tonight is his first episode, if I saw that correctly, on Twitter, on OANN. So I think he's ready.
He got us to talk about it.
Free promotion.
Little did I know what I was doing.
No, sorry.
Well, but we should all keep in mind that it was Matt Gaetz, a single member of Congress, who brought the motion to vacate against your former boss, Kevin McCarthy. And he was able to do so, Brittany, because of what McCarthy had to negotiate to become speaker at the beginning of the 118th Congress, putting certain people on the Rules Committee and allowing any one member to have that power to try to kick out the speaker. The rules that have been put forward this time are different. It would take 9 Republicans to oust a speaker. Do you think that will stay firm? Or if Johnson isn't able to get the votes he needs on ballot one, is he going to have to start negotiating, as we saw McCarthy do?
I think going with 9 was a smart place to start, trying to start from a place of strength, where what it had been for a few years had been 5 votes. What it had been historically for a while was 1 vote. So McCarthy brought it back to the 1 vote. I believe that we started with the 5 and then brought it down to the 1. So yes, I think that was intentional and strategic in order to be able to negotiate with the Chip Roys, the Tom Massies, the Freedom Caucus folks who aren't sold on him yet. And I wouldn't be, I don't expect that it'll be 9 ultimately. I could see it ranging in the 1 to 5 range. And I might be wrong on this too. We'll see, you know, what ultimately turns out tomorrow, but I don't see 9 is way too many for these Freedom Caucus guys. I think they'll try to do the 5 or below.
How about for just Republicans? There's a proposal here to make it for Republican members only. So Democrats, for instance, would not be able to fire the Republican speaker. Jim McGovern's head exploded when he heard about this, and he put out a pretty stern warning that it would never happen in his statement. What does the final product look like there? Is it D's and R's?
I think it should be both. Ultimately, you know, it's a Congress for the people. So why are Republicans, just because we're in the majority, the only ones who can bring forward that motion? You know, when Democrats, do we want Democrats to do the same thing in a few years, ultimately, when the House flips again? Because that's just the way that Congress works. I think that when you're in the majority and you're in the position of power, you need to be careful about the rules and precedent that you implement, because in a few years, that might come around to bite you.
Well, especially when you're in a majority, but just barely, Brittany. Yeah. Even if Mike Johnson canned on round 1, 2, 3, or whatever, however many rounds it takes to secure the gavel, even if he can get that done, if it proves difficult to accomplish tomorrow, what does that signal about the way legislation is going to move through the House in this Congress, knowing that Donald Trump has some pretty big ticket items he wants to see done in short order?
A lot of people out there are saying that Trump really has these first 2 years to try to push his agenda forward, and that afterwards it's going to be a lame duck. To be honest with you, I feel like we're already kind of going into a lame duck. Like you said, the majority is so slim in the House. In the Senate, it's a little bit stronger, but it's going to be hard to be able to move the needle on some of these Trump things if Republicans and Democrats don't work together. We saw that issue come up with CR funding at the end of the year, only a couple days ago, I guess. But at the end of 2024, we saw that issue come up. We saw Elon come in and try to sway things his way. We see Vivek, we see, you know, the Doge folks, admin folks. So you know what? I am not going to be surprised if this slim majority proves to be pretty tough to navigate.
You know, there's been an idea here that it's different this time, Brittany, than it was for Kevin McCarthy or even for Mike Johnson the first time around, because of the election of Donald Trump. That vote needs to be certified by January 6th, on January 6th, according to the U.S. Constitution. And some think that's enough leverage to get every Republican member of the conference to vote for Mike Johnson so Donald Trump can move into the White House.
I don't envision this going as long as McCarthy's vote did. It was a 15 rounds, but it was also over the course of a few days. I think this will probably get done tomorrow. I wouldn't be surprised maybe if it goes into the early hours of Saturday morning, sort of like it did when it was McCarthy on that final vote. It was very, very early in the morning. But I do think that Republicans are ultimately going to want to come together and push this speaker forward. And no one else is going to be able to get the votes. So they can be upset about it. They can use that to negotiate. But ultimately, I think that's all they have, is the tool to negotiate. I don't think anyone else is going to be able to be in that role unless Trump decided to put an endorsement behind somebody else, which is not going to happen. Yeah. And so I think we'll see it ultimately come together tomorrow.
All right. Brittany Martinez, founder of Espina and Company, and of course, former staffer to Speaker Emeritus Kevin McCarthy, who had to go 15 rounds to secure the gavel at the beginning of the 118th Congress. Thank you so much. We still have, of course, a long day of events, it seems, Joe, to look ahead to for tomorrow.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.